We certainly understand that. And last week, some of the, as we kind of examined a little bit, the extra-biblical non-Christian authors that were, or writers that told these different facts that we know that Jesus was, if nothing else, we know that Jesus was a real person on this earth because these people had nothing to gain if they were outside of our faith, outside of the faith of Christianity, nothing to gain in order to promote Jesus as a, because it would only cause controversy outside of our faith as this man was a controversial figure in and of himself. So all of that evidence was given to us as a way to corroborate what we already know as gospel and as scriptural. This week we're going to, or today we're going to, as I said, we're turning a corner. We're going to be looking at in a theological way, the biblical evidences of the existence of Jesus, the validity of his resurrection. And the first thing you do, you know, and I think Giff even talked about this a little bit, we're building a case. In order to build a case, you have to have evidence of that, and we have been kind of moving through all of the different evidences that we could find. But also, what do you have in a good case? You've got to have witnesses. You got to have those that saw it, that reported it as something that was true. So we're going to be looking at some of the witnesses that Jesus interacted with after his resurrection. The first one was the example of the road to Emmaus. And we all know this story because it's written about in several of the Gospels or several of the Gospel accounts. Cleopas and his friend were walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus and to the city of Emmaus, and Jesus comes up to them and he says, what's going on here? And they said, have you not heard? Are you just getting to Jerusalem now and not heard all of these events of Jesus and his crucifixion and all of this and before? And so then as they walk towards Emmaus, Jesus tells them, kind of reiterates what has happened in the gospel, I mean, as far as the Old Testament, what has happened in the Old Testament to the prophecies that have foretold this to be happening in a way to kind of teach them. But here's the interesting point. They did not know him. Now, if you want to know somebody who was probably the most well-known person in that time, it was probably going to be, Jesus was going to be right up there at the top of near the top of the list or at the top of the list because of all of the, everything that had gone on, the turmoil, the trial, the crucifixion itself, all of these things, and all of his actions beforehand, going to the synagogue, all the miracles he had performed, his face was probably the most well-known, but they did not know him. Now, why was that? We said that, when you look at it, this and other examples, Jesus in this sense, he disguised himself. He made it so that they did not know him. This was kind of a new thing. And when we look at this resurrected Jesus, we look at post-resurrection, he had this ability create a deception of or to mask his identity, basically. So they did not know who he was. So they walked together, and it was getting dark, and he was gonna move on. But they said, "No, please stay. It's dark, and come in and have a meal with us." So they had a meal, and he took the bread, he blessed it, he broke it, he handed it to them, and disappeared. Now that had to be some kind of because when he handed it to them, they knew who he was. He revealed himself at that moment. After he gave them the bread, they knew who he was, and he disappeared. This is a second trait of the resurrected Jesus, that he not only was he would disguise himself, could disguise himself, but also the ability to disappear at will. He had not really used these gifts before, but these were apparently necessary in the telling of this story. As we see moving forward. So so the takeaway from this story, just to help build it, is from those witnesses, Jesus was alive, and they did not know him, then they did know him, and then he disappeared. Moving forward, Jesus appears to the 11. Now at that time, after the crucifixion of Christ, after he was buried, he was in the tomb, the apostles were somewhat reluctant to get out among the Jews, because you saw what happened to them at the garden, how they scattered. You saw what happened to Paul or Simon Peter at the fire prior to it. He denied Christ 3 times. You know, you saw these different things that they were rather nervous about, this mob that had done this terrible deed. So in Luke 24, 36 through 49, the story is just as the two witnesses, the two men, Cleopas and his friend, once that happened, once Jesus disappeared, they got up and they went to Jerusalem, and they went immediately to the apostles to find them and tell them the story. Just after they had told them the story, they were pictured this room that they're in, a locked room. They're in this room, and they are there basically hiding. Jesus appears to them and says, "Peace be with you." Now, think about that moment. Think about the moment where you're in this dark room, and I'll confess to you something. I love scaring people at my job, at my work. There was a lady, Paula Culver, wonderful lady. She retired now, probably because of me in some way. But I had this ability to sneak up while she was walking down the hall. I'm just walking down the hall, minding my own business. She happens to be in front of me. I'm able to up-pace it a little bit, get close to her and say, "Hey, Paula." And she goes, "Oh, my Moody." And I did this several times, but it was kind of a pastime of mine. But that event, that Jesus appearing in the middle of it scared them a great deal. They did not know what was going on. Jesus just appears to them and says, "Peace be with you." They are startled, and at first they think, are they thinking that he's a ghost? They think he's a ghost or a spirit. And in verses 39, this is again Luke 24, verses 38 and 39, he said to them, "Why are you troubled? And why do you have doubts in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I, myself. Touch me and see. The ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." So he was trying to confirm with him that he was real. And this is an evidential point that he was a physical body, because anyone who saw him after that might have thought he was some sort of ghost or spirit or vision, but he had them examine his scars and he knew, just to confirm that he was a real person. So he had a physical body. He was not a spirit or ghost. The next evidence, as we move on, is actually, I'm sorry, I actually need to go back, because this is the second telling in the book of John of, or I'm sorry, in the book of John, the second telling of the appearance to the 11, Thomas not being there at that time. The 11 were in their locked room. Jesus appears to them and says, "Peace be with you." He shows them his scars. Jesus tells them that that as his Father sent him, he is also sending them out. In verses 22 and 23, this is John 20, 22 and 23, it says, "And with that, he breathed on them and said, 'Receive the Holy Spirit. If you have given anyone sins, their sins, if you forgive anyone their sins are forgiven. If you have not forgiven them, their sins are not forgiven.'" So in this story, Jesus showed up, showed them his scars, and as it told in the story of Luke, he gave them an evidence. that he was there. He breathed on them. Another evidence that he was not a spirit, but he was actually a person. He breathed on them, and then because it's specifically written, I think because of evidence that he was a real person, and he is just giving us that example. So next, we move on to another witness, Peter. The story found in John 20, 6 and 7, and I'll just read those verses. It's a short story. Then Simon Peter came, followed him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloth lying there, and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying in the linen cloth, but folded up in a place by itself. What a fascinating little story, because of the evidence that we can find in there to corroborate our argument. It is significant that the linen cloth and the linen and the face cloth were left in the tomb. First of all, it's evidence that, like some would say, and in fact, we read in the story, we're not really touching that a lot today, but the story that guards were paid to say that people came and stole his body, but that an evidence that you could have found of a stolen body is they wouldn't wait to unwrap him. They would not have taken the time to do that, because certainly if they had gained access to the tomb, that stone being rolled away, there were guards there certainly, but the stone being rolled away, they would have done that quickly. You don't have people break into homes and stuff and sit down and thumb through your video collection, or if you still have videos, or CD collection, if you still have CDs, or your book collection, you probably have books, thumb through your collection and pick out the best stuff. They grab it, they get what they need, and get out. So if his body was stolen, it would not have been so intentional to leave those wrappings there, but they would have just taken the body and taken the whole thing, wrappings and all. But I think the most fascinating part of the story is the face cloth, the cloth that wrapped his head. It was not thrown down, cast down, crumpled up. It was not with the linens. It was folded. What does that mean? That's intention. That means it was intentionally folded and placed in its proper place. So that and that tells us that this was not some violent act. It was not some random act. It wasn't that Jesus jumped up off the bed and just tore out of there and that kind of thing. He was intentional. He was doing what he needed to do. And that started with, you know, what's the saying, you know, if you want to have a good day, start by making your bed. This was along those lines, that Jesus was intentionally doing this act to leave. And I find that comforting and fascinating all at the same time. So we have the evidence of Peter seeing this thing. Mary, our next witness, Mary at the tomb. Mary is at the tomb weeping. This is found, this telling that we're doing here, John 20, 11 through 18. Mary is at the tomb weeping. She sees two angels, one at his head, one where his head was, one where his feet were. And they say, "Why are you weeping?" She assumes someone has taken the body of Jesus. And we pick up in verses 14 through 16, John 20, 14 through 16. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Then she, thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turns toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means "Rabboni," which means teacher in Aramaic. Jesus told her not to cling to him, for he had not yet ascended. Do not cling to him, as if he was going to stay around. Mary went and told the disciples what she had said. Very interesting. Jesus, once again, we don't know where he came from, but he was there. Did he walk up? Did he just appear? We don't know, but he was there. But she did not recognize him. Another instance where Jesus masked his identity so that he could have this interaction, basically. But when he said her name, she knew him. And what a comforting sight that must have been, because of what she had just witnessed 3 days prior, and what she was going through to try to get to the tomb on the first day of the week, and yet kind of deal with Jesus' body as a proper burial instead of the hurried version that happened on that Friday. She went and tried to do that, to tend to the body of Jesus, but to find him there had to be an awe-inspiring moment for her. The idea of telling her not to cling to him, as I said a bit ago, he was not, he knew he was not going to be there for long. So don't cling to him as if he's back for good for a long time. Excuse me. So that's the evidence of Mary. Now we come to Doubting Thomas, the story that we all know very well. This is found in John 20, 26 through 29. Thomas was not with the 11 when Jesus first appeared to them. And in verse 25, we'll read that, John 20, 25. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and I put my finger in the nails, where the nails were, and I put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Another translation says, "I will never believe." So I would have thought that this might have been one of those great moments that when he said, "I will never believe," and then Jesus appears, but that happens 8 days later. So 8 days later, they were all gathered behind a locked door again. Jesus appears to them in their midst. Jesus told Thomas, instantly went right to him and said, "Touch my scars." And he did, of course. And then Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." So Jesus appeared instantly with these powers. He was behind the locked door. Thomas touched the scars. So he touched the physical scars of Jesus' body. Although his body had been raised, it was the same body. Some have said that if his body was raised, why was it not a fresh, clean, new body? Probably for this purpose, to say that, no, I am not a different person. I am the same person, and I have been raised as it was foretold. So Thomas is another witness, because now is it Minnesota, the Show Me State? Missouri, sorry, Minnesotans. Missouri, the Show Me State. So that's where Thomas came from. So we have Thomas's evidence. He could not deny it at that point that Jesus had risen by the ability to touch his scars. Then we have Jesus appearing to the 7. What a fascinating story this is. This is when Peter, Thomas, Nathaniel, James, and John, and two others were gathered together, and Peter said, I'm going to go fishing. Then they all joined him. Then they went fishing. They fished all night. They did not catch anything. Jesus stood. I don't know if he appeared, but he was there on the beach. But Jesus was on the beach watching them. And he asked them, had they caught anything? And they said, no. And he said, cast your nets on the right side. And then, of course, their nets became so full that they could barely handle them. And in verse 7, it says, then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off for the exercise of fishing, and jumped in the water. Then the other fishermen followed, dragging the huge net full of fish with them, and Jesus was there. So at that moment, John recognized him, or he made himself recognizable. When John saw him, he told Peter, and Peter, of course, being the impetuous one that Peter is, jumped in the water and swam towards Jesus, and then they had breakfast together. They had fish for breakfast. So our takeaway from this story is, once again, Jesus reveals himself to his disciples, and another word is that is used in appearing is manifest himself, is in another translation. This would indicate that making himself visible to them. This is another miracle, after this miracle, John recognized him and told Peter after the miracle had taken place. I don't know what the significance of that is, but the fact that this is the second time of the great haul of fish. Isn't it interesting? At the beginning of his ministry, Jesus performs this miracle and then calls them to be fishers of men. And at the end of his ministry, he does the same thing. A very interesting point that he does basically the same miracle kind of in a bookend fashion of his ministry. So we have all of these witnesses that have said that the evidence that Jesus had risen. Now, there's a lot of speculation of oh, yes. Excellent point. This is the third evidence that Jesus had eaten food as another testament to or as evidence that he had a physical body. I actually had that in the notes, so thanks for reiterating that. So appreciate it. So as we take that evidence all into consideration, that he was not a spirit, that he was a physical body, that he interacted with people, this new body, this resurrected body of Jesus was the same, and yet it was different. There were aspects of his character that were different, or traits that he portrayed. Moving to other evidence of Jesus' resurrection, we have to look at something that happened prior to his crucifixion, and that's the transfiguration. There's a lot of comparison made of the transfiguration being somewhat of a, I won't call it a dress rehearsal, but somewhat of a way to show that he would be changed, that he would be transformed in a sense from one existence to another. When he had gathered his disciples up, and he had, this was the moment where Jesus said, told Paul, told Peter, to get behind me, Satan. When Jesus had first said, I am going to die, I am going to be taken to these people, I am going to be crucified, and I'm going to die, and I am going to be raised. Peter pulls him aside, says, no, that will never happen. And then he says to him, Satan, get behind me. Because if you look at it, Jesus was certainly nervous about what was about to happen, apprehensive about it. You can see evidence of that in the Garden of Gethsemane. He knew what his role was, but still, to be 100% man and also 100% God, the man part was concerned about this. Who would not be, knowing what was about to happen? So he was concerned. In verse 9, when they were coming, oh no, let me not get to that point. But so Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." He was tempted. You would think that if Peter had said, "No, we won't let this happen," certainly he could have, in an instant, just made all of that go away. All of the what was about to happen, just not do it. Got to transform my slides. So he was nervous about it, and Peter was actually giving him an out, and he knew he could not take that. So he said, "Get behind me, Satan! You know, don't tempt me to do this." After that, he took Peter, James, and John to a high mountain. Jesus was transfigured and appeared in gleaming light. You know, his robes were as white as light, and appeared with Moses and Elijah. The apostles wanted to make tents for them, thinking that they were, you know, they had had a long journey, you know, from heaven to come down, and they needed to have tents to rest, and that was not the purpose of that. But while Peter was still saying that they could make tents for all three of you, a cloud appears around them, and God's voice appears that he says, while they were still speaking, a bright cloud covered them. This is verse 5 of Matthew 17. A cloud appeared around them and said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." So they fell down on their face. Then I think it's very interesting that at this moment they fell down on their face. All of this stuff is happening. Jesus touches them. And when they lift their heads, it's just them. Just Jesus and the three of them all alone. Very interesting point, Ed. But the correlation to the resurrection comes in verse 9. It says, "As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, 'Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead.'" So they had this evidence, all this stuff, or this witness of all these things, this great, wonderful thing that had happened, and he was specifically instructed them not to tell anyone until he was raised from the dead. Why was that? We'll examine that in just a bit. But the what happened at the Transfiguration? What was the purpose of it? Was it just to show them? I think if you look at it deep enough, there may be two reasons for the Transfiguration. One, knowing that Jesus was apprehensive about what was happening, could this not have been an encouragement from his heavenly Father to say, you know, to kind of bolster his resolve or bolster his countenance of what was about to happen? So he is rejuvenated at this point. He is refocused on his role. He knows his part to play in all of this. This could have been one of those moments where Jesus could have been at a low point or getting there, and then he is confirmed or affirmed as what he was about to do. Second, this was a wonderful, excuse me, I may have to mute myself. A little water. Second, this was in the mortal minds to see Jesus, to understand his resurrection, they needed to see him, they may have needed to see him in this transformative state. So when he saw them there, why Moses and Elijah? For the witnesses standing there, this was a wonderful way to confirm what his how his part was in the whole scheme of their existence, of the existence of the Jews, of the story of the Jews, because you had the old law represented by Moses, and the old law was to keep them to keep the Jewish nation in a proper state until the emergence of Jesus. And then you had Elijah, the prophets, and the prophet who represented the prophets. So you had all of these prophets that were pointing forward to what Jesus was going to do, what he was going to be. So you had these embodiments of the law and the prophets combined to confirm that Jesus was a part of the same part of that. But Jesus told them told them not to tell anyone until the resurrection, as Peter did in 2 Peter 1, 16 through 18. It could been an indication that the transfiguration was a preview to the resurrection, something that could only be understood after the resurrection. So much of Jesus' teachings to the people, to the apostles, was almost in code. You know, it was in a sense that they could not understand. We don't know why that was done in that way. There's certainly speculation about it. But it was to our benefit, having the whole Bible to look at as a reference, we can understand all of these great things. But Peter said in verse 16, "For we did not follow cleverly devised stories when we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, coming in power. But we were eyewitnesses of His Majesty." We were eyewitnesses to this. The Greek word in there for coming in verse 16 is parousia. I think that's how you pronounce it. A word that generally is saved in the New Testament authors for the second coming of Jesus, coming in power. You can also see 2 Peter 3 and 4 for a reference there. This is another important witness to the fact that His resurrected body was recognizable and could have conversations with others as a test of that. So the transfiguration could have been had a bolstering effect on Jesus Himself, but certainly had a way for them to understand that there was going to be a time that Jesus would be changed, that Jesus would be transformed. So let's see. We have the transfiguration. So in conclusion, as we're, which we're really going great on our time here, we can say that Jesus' body was not taken. We saw that evidence that that there was, it, because of the conspiracy that happened when the guards were paid to tell the people that Jesus' body was stolen, this would have been a way that he could have, that his story could have been diminished. But that obviously did not stick, because the two witnesses that were leaving Jerusalem were among many, many people that had witnessed all of this and knew that these actions had happened. Also, he appeared to witnesses. I was talking to Karen, and I were talking this morning, and I said, "Man, I would have loved Jesus just to appear right in the middle of the Sanhedrin, right in the middle, and said, 'I'm back,' you know, this kind of thing." But he did not. Why he didn't go right to Pilate and say, "I'm back, Caiaphas, I'm back," all of these different people that he could have, he did not. He came to these witnesses, and in fact, he did it in a mystery to a certain point. He was a mystery to them, and then he revealed himself. Certainly, more evidence of his power, his ability to do these things, but the fact that he was a real person and he had really raised from the dead was the evidence that we needed. His body was transformed and had these new powers. What is our takeaway from this today? The fact that Jesus did die, Jesus was raised, that we can find evidence. We found extra biblical evidence that he existed, that he died, that as far as Josephus went, reported, he was raised and he was the Messiah. But we, in our faith, we really don't need any more evidence than the Bible to tell us that Jesus was real, that he died for our sins, that he was raised on the third day, and that many people saw him. He also did, before he went up to heaven, he did many miracles. He was seen by other people at different times. And I think all of this is that it goes to the humility of Jesus. He was not one to necessarily, draw in the crowd for the sake of them seeing him. The crowd drew to him because of what he was doing and what his miracles and his words that were confounding them. They did not understand the wisdom that was coming out of his mouth and drew people to him. But he still drew these crowds, but his humility remained intact. And that is really evidence in his resurrection, because he was not he did not go to the middle of the city, the town center, and stand on a great, you know, stage and present himself to the world. He went to the witnesses, those that probably needed it the most, the ones who were certainly his apostles were at their lowest. And I won't judge their faith at that moment. He had been telling them the whole time that through either innuendo or some of the stories that he had said, or close to the end directly, that he would be raised. But still, they had trouble believing that in the finite mind of humanity. And I've often said that how in the world, when the Jews were in the wilderness, how in the world could they have lost their faith when there is a pillar of fire and smoke leading them across there and they're getting fed every day, but yet they still lost their way seeing this physical evidence. Thomas, the example of Thomas, we said, Jesus told him that you need to touch and feel, to see in order to believe, but blessed are those who do not need to see and still believe. And that's us today. We don't have the physical evidences of miracles, of the different signs and wonders that they had back then, and yet we still believe. So that's really a testament to our faith that we can continue, even in this tumultuous world we're living in these days. We still have the ability to maintain our faith, and through evidences of Jesus' existence that we found in the Bible. And as GIF moves forward with this case of Jesus' resurrection, we will certainly find that our faith can be strengthened by all of this. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and Doug helping me along there with that comment. So, and we will be dismissed.